Clouds will cover the glow of a waning moon in Oregon and California tonight. That same moon will shine brightly on the U.S. borderlands, though. So brightly, in fact, that people walking across the desert probably won't even need flashlights to see their way. That's not going to make that way much easier, not by a long shot. Untold people die every year crossing into the U.S. on foot from Latin American countries. Many thousands more are deported from the U.S. after risking everything they own to come here. Whether you see these people as illegal trespassers in wanton disregard for the law, or as refugees fleeing violence and poverty partly created by U.S. foreign policy, they are indisputably people. This hour, we discuss an effort to help them survive and find footing on their way north or after being deported. Our guest is a former Ashlander, a retired public health nurse, and she now lives in the mountains of southern Arizona. She wrote a book. It's called A Land of Hard Edges, and it's about her experiences volunteering at a shelter to serve migrants in Nogales, Mexico. Peg Bowden, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So, Peg, you open your book, A Land of Hard Edges, with the words, "There are moments in our lives that change us forever." Which moment changed the course of your retirement years?
I think the assassination of Gabby Giffords.
Oh, well, the shooting. She didn't die.
The shooting. Thank you. But the assassination of several others that were with her, mm-hmm. which was in 2011. Prior to that time, I live in a remote part of Arizona on a ranch. I was enjoying my retirement. Actually, I was recovering from a serious illness as well. And I was playing in a band. I used to play in the Rogue Valley Symphony here, and painting. But when that happened, I decided I live in a democracy. I need to wake up. I need to get more involved. I need to find out what's going on in terms of guns, but also in terms of the immigration crisis, which was happening right at my doorstep, which up to that point I knew about on an intellectual level, but not really on a personal or emotional level.
And how did you get from being, you know, racked and shaken by the gunning down of a United States Congresswoman from Arizona in a parking lot to volunteering at a shelter in Nogales, Mexico, right across the border from where you lived near Nogales, Arizona?
Well, I began paying attention to what I was seeing around me. Mm-hmm. When I drove to the grocery store, which is about a half hour drive for me, I would see young men being picked up at the side of the road on a country road by Border Patrol. They wore dark hoodies. They had gallon jugs of water in their hand. And, you know, they didn't look like terrorists to me. They didn't look like drug smugglers. They looked like lost boys in a lost land. And when I tried to find out where they were going, what was going on with them, when I talked with Border Patrol, I got nowhere. So quite by accident, I found out about a group called the Samaritans, which is kind of a renegade group of senior citizens who were very actively involved in putting water in the desert in order to prevent deaths of lost souls, be they American, Mexican nationals, whoever. And so I showed up at a meeting, cold, didn't know anyone, was very moved by their activism, because I don't know if you're, in 2011, Congress was forever debating the pros and cons of changing our immigration policy. And I couldn't follow the arguments, to be perfectly honest, but what I could respond to were people dying in the desert, not too far from my home.
You've described the Samaritans, the group you work with, as people, it's their mission to prevent deaths in the desert. Do you have a sense of how many deaths there are in the Sonora and the Chihuahuan deserts, these vast arid landscapes that connect the U.S. to Mexico?
Yeah, I do. Actually, the deaths are up, even though the numbers of migrants being picked up by Border Patrol are down. In June, July, and August, and September, there were 25 remains found each month just in the Tucson sector of the Sonoran Desert. Now, usually there's 10 to 15 bodies found. I mean, 25 bodies a month is a real jump. And these are remains. So some of the findings by the medical examiner's office. I mean, some of those bodies have been there for years, but others were more recent. So in actuality, there's probably more than 25 a month.
And some terminology there from the United States Border Patrol. You mentioned the Tucson sector.
Right.
That is a huge swatch of the United States. There's also the Marfa sector. I don't have them all in front of me, but they're huge areas of the desert that Border Patrol stations are assigned to. When you talk about 25 remains being found per month over this past summer, can you give us a sense, like, what's the temperature range of the Sonoran Desert on a summer day, like, say, July of 2016?
The temperatures are quite hot, of course. You know, most of the migrants travel at night in order to escape the heat, but it gets, I mean, last summer was a hot summer, and it was between 110, 117 degrees, and, of course, the ground temperature was even higher. There is no way a migrant can carry enough water to sustain themselves between Nogales, Sonora, and Tucson, which is where they're headed. It's a seven-day walk if they're a good hiker. They need several liters, several gallons of water per day to survive, and there's just no way they can carry that much water. So. Yeah.
We're talking with Peg Bowden. She is a member of the Green Valley Samaritans. It's a group of citizens who try to prevent these deaths in the desert by stashing water and also running a shelter. We're going to get to that after a break and learn more about El Comedor and all of the efforts by people in Arizona to bring a little bit of compassion to the situation with people both trying to cross in the United States illegally and being deported from the United States. And then what? Where do they go? How do they get there? Peg Bowden has that information. Her book is called A Land of Hard Edges. Much more to talk about with her on the exchange. I'm Emily Curitan. Please stick with us. First, a short break. On the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Emily Curitan. Our guest is Peg Bowden. Her home is 12 miles from the Mexican border in Arizona. Though she used to live in Ashland, she's talking about experiences volunteering to help people trying to cross the desert into the United States or people who've been deported from the United States. You're welcome to join this conversation with your own experiences, with your questions, with your comments. 800-838-3760 is the number to do that. Or you can send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. Peg, as I mentioned, the border with Mexico is 12 miles away from your ranch in Arizona. It's actually closer to the border than it is to the next nearest town or a mailbox, for that matter. How has the physical border around Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Mexico changed since your childhood?
That's a good question. I grew up in Tucson. And at least once a month, my family would go to Nogales because it was fun. And it was a shopping spree. We took our relatives from Iowa and Minnesota, who were always amazed to be entering a foreign country so close to our home in Tucson. And there was no wall. In fact, there was not even much of a fence. It was like a rusty barbed wire fence that my brother, Chuck Bowden was my brother, who also is a pretty well-known writer. We used to slip under the fence because we didn't want to wait in line to go through the kind of rickety garden gate that stood between Nogales, Arizona and Nogales, Sonora. We call it Ambos
so
Nogales.
You would slip under the fence?
We would, yeah. Okay. We wouldn't wait. Our parents would wait in line. We would just slip under and because it was just more fun to be in Mexico. It was more alive. There was music. There was interesting food. And so Chuck and I would wander around while our parents waited patiently in line to get through, which was the correct way to do it. We were kids.
Right. I mean, a lot of people have these memories of, you know, like Juarez, which was became so infamous as a murder capital in the world and for femicide. People have memories there of riding a trolley across the border in the 1950s and 60s. And it was sort of like the Vegas of Texas. You know, you could go there to have a good time. But now you cross under very different circumstances in Nogales. You cross to work at a shelter. Could you tell us more about that?
Right. Now when I cross, there is a wall about 22 feet high. Mm. It's a metal. On the U.S. side, it looks like we're at war. There are many agents armed to the teeth, wearing Kevlar vests, kind of pacing back and forth in front of the wall. And then when you cross into Mexico, Nogales, Mexico, and I walk, usually from one side to the other, I park in the U.S. side, I walk to the comedor. It's totally different. I walk. First of all, there are no armed men. They say bienvenidos, welcome. Do you need to use the bathroom? Which is right there at their customs station. Of course, they know me because I cross frequently. There's just a sense of friendliness. They want American business for sure, but also there's just a warmth, and there isn't that kind of scary feeling that I get on the U.S. side.
And just to get the image driven home, this wall that's come up, since actually the first Iraq war, it was made out of a runway from Operation Desert Storm. Yes. So basically we're talking about a runway turned up on its side.
Exactly. Uh-huh. It looks like a huge picket fence, and I think it's like 2 or 3, maybe 2 inches in between each slat, so you can see into Mexico and you can sort of put your arm through, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm. And to get a sense, this landscape, though, this is some pretty rugged terrain. This is a desert. This wall's surrounded by thousands of miles of not walled areas, of places where just trying to cross it, whether it's on foot or in a vehicle, is a fraught pursuit. A lot of the people you help at El Comedor have just done that, right, or have done that, seemingly succeeded, made it into the United States, and then been deported. I want to talk about what that process looks like. But first, can you tell us, El Comedor, it's Spanish for the word dining room, but it's much more than just a place to eat. How did this place get started?
Well, the place got started when the Mexican people, particularly a couple of nuns, Sister Engracia, saw hundreds being deported back in 2006, 2007, 2008. And so she began making sandwiches and hot coffee, putting it in the back of her station wagon, and parking near the place where these hundreds of people were deported. And interestingly, she was harassed by the Mexican police for doing this because they thought she was selling the sandwiches. The neighbors saw what she was doing and began to help her. They each pledged to bring 100 burritos a month. That was it, each family. So they were handing out every day hundreds of meals to the migrants that were coming across. Finally, Sister Engracia went to the mayor because she was tired of being harassed by her own police in Mexico. And the mayor
of Nogales,
Sonora, essentially gave her a plot of land, which is really a hillside, a big rock. That's how the Comedor got started. The Comedor is a pretty humble place. It's a dugout spot. The walls are dirt with tarp over them. There's a small kitchen. I'd say the kitchen is 8x10, and they serve 200 or more meals every day of the year, both in the morning and in the afternoon.
200 meals a day, every day of the year. How long can people stay there?
They can stay for several weeks, but I would say most of the migrants use it as a holding zone and are gone within 3 or 4 days. You know, they rest, they heal, they receive counsel from the Jesuits who run the place. It's called the Kino Border Initiative, and the Jesuits and the nuns really are in charge. And so they talk to the migrants, tell them their options. And the following week when I go, most of the migrants are new. They're gone.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Peg Bowden. She's a registered nurse, former Ashland resident, and now lives in Arizona. Her book is called A Land of Hard Edges. It's about her experiences volunteering at the Comidora shelter on the border with Mexico in Nogales to help people that are illegally immigrating to the United States or have just been deported from the United States. You can join our discussion at 800-838-3760 or send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. Peg, you're part of the Green Valley Samaritans. It's part of this binational cooperation of many faith-based organizations who are dedicated to helping migrants and promoting immigration policies, as you guys put it, to affirm the dignity of all people. You guys also have some T-shirts that say humanitarian aid is never a crime. How and when does humanitarian aid, like what you're doing, get treated like a crime?
In Arizona, it's a felony to transport an undocumented person. And often, in my experience, not often, occasionally, I've had to do that as well as my fellow Samaritans. You know, when you find someone in the desert who is dehydrated, who is hallucinating, maybe is semi-conscious, you can't wait. You put them in your car and you get them to help. This is considered a felony in Arizona.
What are you supposed to do?
You're supposed to call the Border Patrol, which actually is the first thing we do. Call the Border Patrol, tell them you have a person that's in trouble. My own personal code is if no one shows up in 10 minutes, I put them in the car and I get them to help.
You have many stories from people in your book, A Land of Hard Edges. You also have a blog, arroya.org, where you post your experiences there. I'm hoping you can share some of the stories from the migrants you've met at El Comidor. And I'm thinking about Alfonso right now.
Right.
Would you tell us Alfonso's story?
Yeah, Alfonso was a butcher from Vista, California. He had four daughters. He's married. Been there for 30 years. He was a good businessman. He was deported kind of on a fluke. He went to the store to get some milk. An agent asked him for his identification. He did not have identification as an American. He had Mexican identification. He was deported to Nogales. And part of what Homeland Security does is it deports people to towns far away from their hometown as a psychological ploy, really, because it's much harder for them to return. So I met Alfonso because he had been wandering the desert. His feet were a mess. The blisters were severe. So I chatted with him. He spoke perfect English. And he told me, I said, well, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to get back. I've got to get back. You know, I've got a store, I've got a job. And I thought to myself, well, there's no way he's going to get back in the near future because he can hardly walk. Well, I was wrong about that because in 3 days, Alfonso did try and cross again through our desert with a friend and died actually at the base of Babokivari, which is a sacred mountain of the Tohono O'odham Indians in the Sonoran Desert. His friend, who he was with, ran to get the Border Patrol. This is when Alfonso was still alive, but not able to walk anymore. And the Border Patrol, he said, you know, it's about a half hour, maybe an hour walk back to Alfonso. Please come with me because my friend is still alive, but he really needs help. Border Patrol agent refused to do that. And instead arrested the friend, and Alfonso died. About a week later, the Border Patrol couldn't find Alfonso. So they went back to the friend, who was now in jail, took him out of jail and said, please take us to the place where your friend, where you last saw your friend. And the friend did this, and of course, Alfonso had died at that point. Hmm. And I guess I never forgot this incident because I got to know him. He showed me pictures of his family. I wrote about it on my blog, and the daughter contacted me.
Oh, really? What did she have to say?
She said the family was devastated. She thanked me for writing about it. She thanked me for helping him. She sent me a picture of an altar that they had created in their living room. Talked a bit about him as a father. It was a wonderful exchange that I had, but the family was devastated.
How do you feel when you hear immigrants characterized as criminals and, you know, as real dangers to our society, the kinds of jobs that these people were coming to have? And do you feel threatened as someone who lives on the, you know, on ground zero of where people cross?
Yeah, you know, so many of my friends, actually many of them here in Ashland, think I'm a little crazy doing what I do, because the media has portrayed Ambos Nogales, both Arizona and Sonora, as a crime-ridden zone. Interestingly, Nogales, Arizona has one of the lowest crime rates in Arizona, one of the lowest in the country, actually. But in terms of the people I meet, you know, I know many of them have been in prison. They've been in our prison system.
Immigration crimes?
Right, for immigration crimes. Many of them multiple times, because if they're caught once, it's 30 days. If you're caught twice, it's 60 or 90 days. So the sentence goes up. And, of course, the euphemism is we call them detention centers. But I've been to these places, and they are indeed prisons. So, I'm sure some of the people I meet have done some bad things. But 99% of the people I meet, first of all, they're at the lowest point in their lives when I see them. That is a humbling experience for me. For me, a privileged white grandmother, to be in the presence of a person who has lost everything, who is hurting on many levels, who's been injured. They're not a danger. They're desperate. This is not a lark. This is not some sort of fun trip they're going to take across the desert. Many of them have almost died. It's an amazing experience to me, which is why I keep going back, I guess, to the Comodoro. I was going to go back for 1 year, and now I'm on my fifth year.
Fifth year volunteering at a shelter in Nogales, Mexico. We're talking with Peg Bowden. She lives on the U.S. side, Nogales, Arizona, and commutes daily. She used to live in Ashland and was a registered nurse here for many, many years. Part of this sort of skills you're able to bring to this shelter. You know, you talk about how humbling it is to be around people when they are in the pits, when they are at a real low point of being alive. Do you ask them questions like why? I mean, that's not always a compassionate question to ask someone, but do you say, you know, why are you doing this? Why have you left your home and put yourself at such great risk and oftentimes lost out to do this, to come into our country?
Yes, I ask them that all the time, actually. Why are you here? And they tell me, well, many of them have lived here in the U.S. for 20, 30 years. So they just want to get home. They feel like they're more American than they are Mexican. Some of them have tried to get a legal residency. They have tried to get a visa. It is a long, difficult process, and it costs a lot of money, a lot of lawyers. Then there are people who are traveling north from Central America, from Chiapas, the southern parts of Mexico. And they are fleeing countries that are in disarray, where there is violence, there is poverty, there are drug gangs.
Like El Salvador and
Guatemala,
places with recent civil wars. Honduras, right. One of the most sort of violent places you could be right now.
Right. I meet people from those places every week. Yeah.
And so do you have a different understanding now that you've asked so many people why, or can you just see it in their faces?
I can certainly see it in their faces, particularly the people from Central America. They have a haunted look. They are very closed down. Many have been traveling on La Bestia, which is the beast. It's the train that comes from Central America up into Mexico. A very, very dangerous journey. I've met young men who have lost limbs because they've fallen off the train and have been run over by the train.
Children end up in the Comedor, yes, unaccompanied children?
Yes. Most of the children are with their moms or an aunt or an older sister. But a couple of years ago, when the great surge from Central America of women and children landed in Nogales, there were 2,400. Now, they weren't all at the Comedor, but they were essentially put in a warehouse, actually, on the Nogales, Arizona side. And I'll have to say, you know, I'm sort of speaking ill of the Border Patrol agents. They did a pretty good job in caring for this huge population of kids. There were a lot of unaccompanied children. It was devastating.
Well, I think one of the big takeaways in your book, A Land of Hard Edges, is that this is complicated from a policy perspective, from the perspective of Border Patrol or people who have a mandate to do a certain thing or carry out a law and maintain law and order here in the United States. It's not a black or white issue. Much more to talk about with Peg Boden here on the Jefferson Exchange about her experiences living on the U.S.-Mexico border as we live in a time where the word deportation is gaining political currency. We're going to get more into that on the other side of a break, and you can join this discussion. The phone number and email address are on the way. I'm Emily Curitan. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. We're talking with Peg Boden. She's the author of A Land of Hard Edges, Serving the Front Lines of the Border. It's about her experiences volunteering in a shelter called El Comedor on the U.S.-Mexico border in Nogales, Sonora, Nogales, Arizona. You can join our discussion with your thoughts, your stories of immigration, or your questions for Peg. It's 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So, Peg, that last segment, we really heard about some real suffering and kind of the low point in people's lives and how they lose their lives trying to get a crack at the American dream, just trying to have a livelihood. What's the flip side of that in this work you do? You said you're in your fifth year going back to El Comedor. Where do you find your joy and your strength working there?
Well, strangely enough, the Comedor is an interesting place in that each week I experience a whole range of emotions, from despair all the way to joy. The nuns who run the place like music, so they often put a boombox on with some pretty wild salsa music or Mexican music. And, you know, sometimes the migrants get up and start and they'll grab me and start to dance, which is great. Also, Father Samuel, one of the priests there, pretty good guitar player. He knows every barroom song, I think, in Mexico. So he'll pick up his guitar, begin singing, the nuns join him, and of course then the migrants all join him. And so there's music, there's laughter, little craziness, little hysteria sometimes. And then everybody's out the door, and you know, we bring clothing down too, the Samaritans do, as well as food, clothing. So they march out of the Comedor often with a fresh pair of socks, hopefully a pair of shoes that fit. I mean, there's nothing that feels better than a new outfit, right? And of course, some of the donations from Americans are Patagonia, Gap. I mean, some pretty high-end stuff. So it makes me chuckle to see these people who have absolutely nothing walking out the door, getting ready to face God knows what, but at least they have a good shirt and a clean pair of socks.
And who are the Samaritans?
The Samaritans are kind of I won't say a ragtag group because we're pretty organized now. There's about 300 of us, mostly retired people who live in Green Valley, which is a retirement community. I live on a ranch. I don't live in Green Valley, but it's a smattering of all faiths, and I would say no faiths. I would say probably half or more are atheists.
Really?
Yes. Lots of Unitarians, but Buddhists, Jews, Christians, and everything in between.
Are you a woman of faith?
I don't attend church. but yes, I would say one of the gifts I've gotten from the Samaritans and from certainly from the migrants is that something is keeping these people going. they tell me stories. They tell me of falling down in the desert, being abandoned by their coyotes, which is the guides. And they tell me, so I woke up, I heard my daughter's voice saying, get up, get up. Or I heard the Virgin of Guadalupe telling me, you only have 2 blocks to go and there is help. And my non-believer friends say, well, yeah, they're hallucinating. But, you know, something drives people to get up when they're close to death. And I've met many people who have responded to things that I really can't explain.
Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned coyotes. These are people who guide others across the border for money. The price of passage, which is to be included in maybe one of these hiking groups with or without ground transportation, a lot of times just having someone point the direction for you as you walk for a week across a waterless landscape. Tell us about your impression of coyotes and why they aren't allowed in the shelter at Comedor.
Right. The coyotes generally work for the cartels. The cartels, sort of like the mafia in Mexico, the cartels control the drug trade, and they're pretty much controlling human trafficking at this point. It's a mixed bag. Many coyotes are American. They are guides who make a lot of money, their job is to guide groups of Mexican undocumented people to a safe place. Often their plans go awry and the people are abandoned in the desert and they die. Mm. But I've met some good coyotes too, who have been doing it for years and who stand by the people that they're guiding. So like so many difficult situations in our politics right now, it's not a black and white issue. There are some good people doing illegal things.
Mm-hmm. And people who rise to the challenge. Do you remember Rodolfo from Mazatlan? He's a story you share in your book.
Right.
And he carried a woman.
That's right. Yeah.
And her daughter, at expense of his own passage, he ended up being picked up by Border Patrol, but was able to get them to a safe place. And you heard his story, and I can see why you wouldn't be able to just pull it out of your hat, because there are so many stories in this book, A Land of Hard Edges, and so many on your blog, arroyo.org, of your 5 years very actively volunteering your time to help people either traveling north to the U.S. or people who have been deported and, as you said, kind of dropped off in a city that they have no connection to, with no money to get anywhere else, possibly no money to get anywhere else. Your family has a long connection to understanding the dynamics of these border issues and the complications of the U.S. war on drugs. Would you mind talking about that a little bit more?
Sure. Chuck Bowden, or Charles Bowden, was my brother. He tragically died 2 years ago. He's written 34 books, many articles for Esquire, Gentleman's Quarterly, Harper's. Any rate, he lived in Tucson, stayed in Tucson most of his life. I moved to Oregon, lived in the Rogue Valley for 30 years. But Chuck was passionate about the issues he saw, particularly the dark underbelly of what he saw in our own politics and in the politics of Mexico. He wrote a lot about Juarez. Shortly before he died, he lived in Las Cruces, so he was traveling to Juarez quite a bit because it's closer.
And what insights in terms of his reporting on the drug war and the cartels and our impressions of that, what did he impart to you or change your views?
Well, he firmly believed, and I think he was right, that the cartels have a relationship with Homeland Security. I mean, let's face it, the drug war is a joke. drugs are more plentiful, easier to get, and cheaper now than they were 5, 10, 20 years ago. So the war on drugs hasn't worked. What he said, and I believe, is that most of the drugs that enter our country do not come on the backs of migrants wandering the desert. Mm-hmm. They're coming in the trucks going through the ports of entry, Nogales being a major one, and getting to places like Portland, Chicago, New York, where there are cartel members, Mexican mafia members, in these cities to distribute the drugs. He was saying this 10, 15 years ago when most people thought that was a pretty crazy idea. But there's been numerous articles now, about this collusion.
And you write in your book, which really focuses, as opposed to some of your brother's work, not that his doesn't focus on the human stories, but in your book, you're very much present with these people and kind of relating what you see in a non-judgmental way, and infusing compassion into that, which I really appreciated and I got out of reviewing this. You write that you respect law and order and the stability it brings your life as a United States citizen. Mm-hmm. You also write about how when you see these young men in hoodies with backpacks carrying their jugs of water into the desert, you root for them. You want them to make it safely and find success in the American dream. How are your perspectives here at odds with one another, and how do you reconcile them?
Well, that's an interesting question. Excuse me. I think it just all boils down to, when a person is thirsty, you give them water. I don't care who they are. And so I guess what that means is there are times when I'm bending the law. But I guess I'm trying to operate on more of a moral law. And that's how I reconcile that. You know, I really have to kind of reach into, I've been in situations where someone was desperate. I was on the U.S. side. And the person wanted to continue. So I'm in a van with Samaritans. We give the person food. We give the person water. We have clothing. And the person says, I feel better now. I want to continue. So I don't call the Border Patrol. The people usually ask one question, which way is north? Mm. I point to north, and they're on their way.
And are there citizen vigilante groups that are a foil to the Samaritans?
Yes, there are. And I will have to say, since our election a week ago, although it was happening shortly before that, there have been numerous militia groups who are training in the Sonora Desert. When I've gone on water drops, that is, I go out with a group to various sites where there are migrant trails. We leave gallons of water for anyone.
To try to cut down on that 25 bodies being found a month.
We feel like we're saving lives. We've seen militiamen nearby. We've seen Border Patrol nearby. And we've gone back in an hour, and the bottles have been slashed. So just a week or two ago, one of the Samaritans asked the Border Patrol, I said, so who slashed our water bottles? And the Border Patrol said, it wasn't me. It was not the Border Patrol. And I don't want to comment any further. So it wasn't javelina, wild animals out there. I'm sure the militia are going to be more aggressive and possibly menacing. I know in our last Samaritan meeting, we talked about this, about nonviolent resistance, about if there's confrontation, we need to back off, get in our car, drive away. So, yeah.
And the migrants themselves, I used to report on the U.S. border, so I'm infusing this with a little bit of my perspective here. I mean, people, when you find these bodies, these remains, they're generally people with a backpack, mm-hmm. with a hoodie. Mm-hmm. With maybe some food, maybe some family photos, mm-hmm. maybe a rosary. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they don't tend to have drugs in those backpacks, right. Do they? We're not dealing with smugglers here. We're dealing with, right. with human trafficking, right. People who want a better life.
In fact, I've met Border Patrol agents. Usually when I'm out on a water drop, we have a sign on our van that says Samaritan. So the Border Patrol knows we're there, et cetera. And they've said, if I look off in the distance and there is a group and they are not carrying a a burlap sack, which is generally what they carry when they're hauling marijuana or cocaine. Mm. Says if they're not carrying a burlap sack, I just let them go. I just go after the drug smugglers.
Can you tell us, with just a couple minutes left, about the migrant trail walk?
Yes, the migrant trail walk occurs the last of May, beginning of June. It's the hottest time of the year. It goes from Sasebe, which is a border town, all the way to Tucson. It is 75 miles. People walk this trail because many migrants walk this trail in order to, well, for a lot of reasons, sometimes very spiritual reasons, but also physically, just to feel what it's like for a migrant. However, you know, they have a wagon that is following them with water and food. And on one of those days, I go out with a group and we feed this group lunch. But it's been a time, people use the desert for reflective pilgrimages, and this is a pilgrimage.
A long history of that, and also for building some empathy and compassion. We've certainly gotten a dose of that today from Peg Bowden. She's a registered nurse, retired now, and working on the U.S.-Mexico border. Reaching Across the Fence is the name of her lecture tonight at SOU Recital Hall. It's free and open to the public at 7 p.m. Thanks for being here, Peg.
Thank you.